Good people skills required must be able to please all the people all the time while taking the really tough and difficult decisions. You'll be working with a great team, many of whom want your job, and all of your 86,000 stakeholders expect you to be instantly available to answer their call. This is a 5-year post, provided you don't upset too many people. So who'd want to be the Chief Minister? Well, Alf Cannon seems keen, and he joins me on today's perspective. It's fair to say the last couple of months, certainly since the budget, have been an interesting time to be Chief Minister.
Absolutely. I think the budget, perhaps, although I think well trailed that it was going to be a difficult budget, did catch many people by surprise, particularly around this headline tax increase. And, you know, if I step back and if I'm honest, I think some of the communication around that, the way that it was brought over and communicated about where the emphasis of the budget was in terms of the expenditure, where what we were focusing on in terms of health and childcare provision, and also the benefit uplift for child benefit as well, and the extra support that would give to working parents. I think a lot of that was not well communicated, and I think from a strategic perspective in terms of how that fitted into our overall approach and the island plan and building our economy, perhaps some of that was disjointed and disconnected. So one of the jobs that I've clearly marked now for the next few months is to ensure that we do reconnect, and that we do reconnect with the public, we reconnect with business, and we put that emphasis both in terms of reassurance about what we're doing and the knowledge and the assessment of the impacts of what we're doing and why they're beneficial, but also perhaps now take a step back just to listen about where we need to focus, particularly the next budget, but also where we need to focus ourselves over the next 12 months.
Because there were some really good news stories in there. The increases in benefits, particularly child benefits, in answer to the Population Rebalancing Committee, some of the recommendations that Timald approved there, these were good news stories.
So I think the emphasis that we've put on children and families in this budget has been significant. We've talked about the child benefit equalisation for first and second children, the uplift that parents will find over April and May and into next year. We've talked about the additional £3 million that we've put into our early years childcare provision now, so parents will get an extra year's nursery provision supported. So that will be hugely advantageous for them, obviously putting another £18 million into education. But all that will go, I hope, to supporting our greater economic purpose in terms of making it, or parents being confident that we are going to help them in those early years, that we are there for young families, and that we do want to see them succeed in what is pretty tough environment. And then, of course, we put the £40 million into health. It was a huge investment into health on top of the other £20 million that we put as a investment, if you like, into 4,500 operations last year. You know, another £40 million going into health. But the bigger question now for us, I think, having perhaps recorrected some of the positioning, invested in terms of this early years need and our young families, particularly in sort of low to middle income, and I was making sure now that we do not tip the balance whereby the cost of public service delivery exceeds the capability of an economy to pay for those public services. I think that's now the question that is occupying a lot of minds. I said certainly occupying my mind. I think many members in council feel the same. I think we've discussed this with the Treasury Minister now. And, you know, over the next 12 months, I think there are a number of questions that need to be put and answers that we need to get, particularly around healthcare funding, what we're prepared to continue to invest in healthcare versus what leverage is actually available to us from economic growth. And, you know, we need to get that balance right, Phil. I think what else needs to be factored in, of course, and where I think perhaps was not properly explained was, of course, we've had huge costs over the last 4 years. There are £300 million Kate Brunner identified in terms of an outlay. We've had, of course, all the additional costs around the cost of living, the impact of inflation. We've seen that significant government expenditure over expenditure, the need to come to Timald and ask for additional funding across a number of areas, including health. And of course, now we need to bring that back into line and restore financial discipline across government and perhaps redress any culture that's been creeping in during the COVID period that, oh yes, the funding will just be available, because it's very important that we get that financial discipline back as well.
And I suppose that's one of the questions that many people have been asking recently, which is, you know, 2.5 years into your administration, you had 5 years there as Treasury Minister, and we're talking about redefining or rediscovering financial discipline in public expenditure. I'm putting some words into government's mouth there, but many people will think, well, surely to goodness, financial discipline should be there all the time.
Well, it is, of course it's there, but I think what I'm pointing out is that we've had some really exceptional circumstances which have almost forced government to spend the money. Particularly, obviously, the two years over COVID and all the impacts which we're well aware about or well aware of. And then, of course, this cost of living crisis, the fact that government again stepped in to help support people, spent a lot of extra money, the pressures that has put in on our government service delivery, the wage increases that have come through, all this has cost substantial sums of money. And it's not been easy for the government just to say, oh, well, we're not going to give you that check to the departments, you know, and you've got to stop delivering services because, you know, we can't afford it. Because ultimately, that really would not have been fair, I don't think, on the public or realistic. But, you know, inflation's dropping now. Things are a bit calmer. You never know what's coming down the line. But we're effectively regrouping, I think, after what has been a pretty tumultuous period for the public sector, a very tumultuous period for public sector finances. And now we're in, a better position to be able to say, look, you know, we've reorganized ourselves now. We can't, you know, that inflationary pressure has dissipated, has gone away. We're over the shock of Ukraine. We're over the shock of gas prices. We're over the shock of COVID. You know, we need to start to bring about discipline. But of course, discipline does have some consequences, Phil, because it does mean that sometimes public service is not always to the level that everybody wants at any particular time. But nevertheless, we need now, for the greater interests of our long-term security, to get that discipline back, because we've got a financial plan that we've set out over the next 4 or 5 years, which is designed to take away the deficit at the moment and restore us to a position whereby we are returning ourselves back into surplus when it comes to budget. So there's a lot to be achieved. The other point that I want to make is that, you know, we're a government that's found ourselves with significant compression when it comes to waiting lists. So across the health service, there have been thousands of people waiting in various different disciplines for their operations, or even sometimes just to be seen at the very first stages of consultation. And we've seen, for example, in education now, clear evidence that learning has been impacted in some areas because of the lockdowns and the impacts of teachers' strikes and other aspects that have happened. So, you know, we've had a lot of catching up to do. I think we've invested a lot of money, particularly in health, to do that. But that's why you will see a re-emphasis now on that financial discipline, because we have to effectively reinstill within government now the need to adhere to that for the long-term benefits of everybody.
During the course of your 2.5 year journey as Chief Minister, you have lost along the way a number of political colleagues and indeed senior civil servants who have worked very closely with Council of Ministers. Whether this be strategically repositioning or whether it be spending more time in the garden, you're loath to use the word sacked. But how does this encourage a spirit of collective working together for the good of the Isle of Man if people are always looking over their shoulder to see, are they the next one that's going to be encouraged to buy some B&Q vouchers and spend more time in the garden?
So it's absolutely vital that government delivers and delivers for everybody and delivers for the people of the island. And taken a view that where that delivery is not up to scratch, then we've needed to make changes. And partly also some of that was driven on the back of the Employment Tribunal, and I think a need to refresh, shall we say, some of the organisational leadership, some of it which was naturally pretty exhausted by what it had been through, and some of it because actually there was a real definitive need perhaps to bring a different way of thinking to government. So I think we can evidence that we've put in place a lot of refresh structures. I think we can evidence that those will lead to better outcomes. And of course, I can point to the fact that in many areas of our overall ambitions, we are starting to deliver. But there's a huge amount still to do. And that's why we brought forward some refinements to our island plan, and I think some clarity to where the areas of focus needed to be for the next 12 months.
And we'll move on to that shortly. But I mean, well, actually, it's in the plan. So let's talk about what has actually happened. Now, it is difficult, and perhaps more difficult than people might imagine, for a newly elected chief minister to effect immediate change across government. So I think inevitably anyone who observes politics to any reasonable extent will give you the benefit of doubt, perhaps for the first year, that it takes time to reposition and develop your strategic aims and objectives. But we're 2.5 years in now, and many people do scratch their heads and wonder, what actually is this government delivering?
So, first of all, we set out very strongly our economic ambitions. And part of those economic ambitions were to redress the balance of the island. And I think we've been through this a huge number of times. But, you know, I can evidence very clearly. It was nice to hear Paul Crane on your agenda show, I think it was a few days ago, our population guru, point to the fact that, you know, birth rates, for example, have started to climb. I know they're still at historic lows, but they're starting to go back up again. It was good to hear that our plans for economically active people on the island contributing to the economy and the tax base was also so far proving to be and showing that it was on track to deliver. I think there was a lot of calls about housing at the beginning of this administration, and we've driven through a number of programs in terms of encouraging the private sector to keep developing and keep building. You know, we've seen what's happened with
on that housing one, many people, certainly many people I speak to, many of whom are perhaps in the beginning stage of their lives and their careers, are basically saying there's nothing much changed as far as we can see. We still find it all but impossible certainly impossible to buy a house, and even to try and rent a house. It's very much a lottery as to whether you're lucky enough to get there first.
I think I'm not saying that we, by any stretch of the imaginations, we've solved the problem, Phil. I mean, we haven't. You know, there is still some considerable way to go, but the facts are showing that. It's not a case of nothing has happened. I think what I'm showing is that we have driven some of the solutions that are needed to this. And I think, you know, people tend to look to government, but I think we've looked to the private sector and tried to make sure that our clarity of vision when it comes to policy and island plan policy, clarity of vision more so when it comes to planning. And that's why we've had the major applications scheme put in to handle those bigger applications and try and help them through the planning process as quickly and smoothly as possible. That's why, for example, I know this bit's yet to come to fruition. We've done the island infrastructure scheme, and you know, in the next 18 months, I really hope to see spades in the ground and that delivering as well, and that will go some way. And we've seen MDC building there, starting their project up at Westmoreland Road, which is one example of what can be established and delivered. And there have been, despite this myth I've heard that no public sector housing units have been built, is not true actually, because across the island the local authorities in some areas have carried on with their projects and housing units have been built. But yes, I mean, I think we've got a long way to go. We're going to continue to focus on it, and housing remains one of the priorities for this administration.
And I suppose it's not so much a myth as a misunderstanding or a different interpretation of figures, because a number of the houses that have been the new houses that have been developed are effectively replacements for previous houses that had run well past the end of their useful lives.
So sure, I mean, I think some of the figures need drilling down into. I don't always get the exact data in terms of, you know, but I've certainly seen the number of units that have been. So even if they're old units and they've been brought back into life or they've been brought up to date, that's still a better position than having nothing invested at all. But, that, you know, there is a long way to go. It is quite a complex issue, actually, housing. But I think we've made some clear steps forward. We're clear in our own minds that particularly with the private sector provision was vital. There's a long way to go, I think, in terms of the government's housing stock. We've set our stall out quite clearly around the creation of a housing association. I was actually discussing that a couple of days ago with the Council of Ministers, and you know, we're keen now to make sure that that does come to fruition and that we bring those plans forward later this year, and preferably before this term, this summer term finishes. So there's still a lot to do, but we are making progress, and you know, I think there are areas now that need additional focus, particularly rental accommodation. Clearly see with concern and hear from concern from estate agents, from constituents, they can't get rental accommodation. It's always very difficult to find. So there's huge amounts for us still to do. It won't just be solved in this administration. It will always be an ongoing issue. But so far, you know, we are making steps, and I believe that we can evidence that we've taken positive steps forward.
Tynwald backed your revised strategy document. What's the Our Island Plan? Revised principles that you're aiming to deliver. A number of these principles seem to be similar to previous principles. I'm just trying to find them. Here we are. Yes, redefine strategic priorities. That's the ones. What seasoned political operators would say is, if you want to understand what government's priorities are, look to see where the money is going. So you've just had your budget, you've got your redefined strategic priorities. There are six of them: financial discipline, economic development, residency, migration and security, more homes occupied, energy security and travel connectivity, air and sea, improved travel connectivity, that one is. So if the old adage is right, if you want to know what a political mind is thinking, follow where the money's going. What money, extra money, has gone into these six areas to help deliver on these strategic priorities?
So there is investment taking place. For example, in terms of connectivity, we are working with airlines at the moment to ensure that they have that they are supplying their routes, and that government is providing them with the right support level to ensure that some of those routes did stay working and stay in existence, even if, you know, for the airlines, they would rather have them shut down. So we are investing in that particular area. And clearly we continue to stay in close contact, you know, with the steam packet in terms of their current status. But the energy issue is an issue that we, at the moment, we'll need investment, but one of the priorities clearly is to keep on top of that and to make sure that people are continuing to progress in terms of the plans that they have. And we're waiting, obviously, for the Manx Utilities Authority to push further forward with their plans. That will need some funding if they are approved for turbines. That will, of course, need capital, some form of capital expenditure, and that will come forward under the capital programme. I don't think that's necessarily going to happen this year, but remains to be seen. And then when you're looking at housing, I think, well, we've been through it. You know, clearly the Manx Development, an arm's length body, is actually securing the funding in terms of the housing investment that's coming, leading housing investment that's coming through in terms of that Westmoreland Village proposals. And of course, the local authorities continue to borrow. So you won't necessarily see that all in a sort of clear vanilla perspective from the budget. And often these are activities that are taking place off balance sheet, if you like, behind the scenes and with other organisations. But money is going into our priorities. As we said, you know, the biggest, you know, within this, though, we've still got to maintain high levels of public service. We've set very much our stall out by trying to tackle some of the health issues, and thousands of people, as we know, have benefited, but thousands are still needing to benefit from our healthcare system. And that's why we've put that extra money in now to try and assist Manx Care in meeting that need for the people. So, you know, these priorities are helping us refocus in terms of identifying where we really need to what we really need to get on top of in terms of both immediacy for the benefit of the island, but also in terms of the longer term, because if they're not delivered in the next 12 months, then they'll impact our future energy for security, for example, or of course set us back maybe on housing programs.
So looking then at the redefined strategic priorities, the first one, financial discipline. We will focus on financial discipline so that public services are delivered within budget. I mean, that's the day job, surely.
Well, you say that, Phil, but a lot of this, I mean, okay, so it's pretty clear that the big overspends are in, you know, what you might call demand-led services. So health, in education, and in say home affairs, the front line, you know, policing, where you can't always see what the stress levels are going to be. So it's not always that easy to plan ahead with clarity. Nevertheless, you know, as I said, we've had exceptional years now. We've had almost four exceptional years of problems and issues that have, to a large extent, have been outside our control. And the reason why that is there is to send a very firm message now to the chief executive officers and those in charge of the budgets that, you know, we can only sustain so much in terms of tackling the immediate problems, and we now need to rethink through how we are addressing immediate problems if they occur, and also with the health service, for example, which really is the big, the issue of the day in terms of demand versus capability versus financing versus the economic ability to pay for it. But also in terms of the healthcare services, to help perhaps focus some minds around what they are delivering, where they are delivering it, and what they are taking on, because there's huge scope of work in this merged health and social care system. There are other pressures coming on from, say, the number of children who are coming forward now needing assessment and potential treatment through our mental health system and reporting in with ADHD and other issues. And equally at the other side of the spectrum, you know, I think there's increased demand also amongst the elderly population. So, and you've got to balance that out with this absolute immediate need that we have to go and see GPs. We've obviously got these dentist waiting lists. We've got to tackle some of the waiting lists in some of the other critical areas. Having said all that, you know, I think I don't want to leave without the impression that we haven't been tackling some of this, because waiting lists in some areas have come down. We've conducted 4,500 additional operations to help people with, particularly in the sort of orthopaedics. And there are initiatives afoot for us to try and keep, you know, on top of some of these critical areas, but challenging.
One of the next priority in the list of redefined strategic priorities is economic development. Now, you're talking about 1,800 new jobs to be created or filled, indeed, by 2026. There is some encouraging news in that direction. Another bit of encouraging news is that we seem to be getting a higher tax take, which again is encouraging. But is this partly just a kind of a bounce back from the depressed state that the economy got into during the COVID period with lockdowns and the like? Have we actually recovered to the levels that we were at prior to COVID as yet?
I think that we have evidenced that the economy is recovering in some critical areas, in terms of if you look at visitor numbers, for example, and I think actually the overall impacts over COVID, although we had a lot of expenditure, and income levels will have definitely been impacted. I think we're pretty much probably where we should be. There's still some way to go. But I think obviously you have to factor in, of course, the inflationary impacts as well. Nevertheless, I'll have to leave all the absolute analysis to the economists. The bottom line is, you know, we have pushed forward in terms of our income levels, which is encouraging. And that is, you know, will be encouraging for the future, particularly as we set out a financial plan, a fiscal plan that is trying to return us to a position of surplus. So I think the encouragement is there. That's the critical point there. This is on an upward curve.
The budget, obviously, was quite significantly panned by the survey that the Chamber of Commerce did. There was an awful lot of criticism in there, or lack of confidence, perhaps, was a better way of putting it. Clearly, if you're to deliver on this redefined strategic priority, you really do need people who run businesses on the Isle of Man to believe in this project, don't you? Well, first of all, were you surprised at the level of criticism that effectively came from that survey that the Chamber did? And secondly, how do you, as Chief Minister, convince people that actually what you've said in all these documents is really going to happen and it is going to be delivered?
So I think this comes down to, and we started this programme off by saying that the communications, I think the communications around the budget in terms of where its impacts would be felt and what it was trying to do in terms of supporting the community, particularly when it came to health, when it came to children and families, and the benefits that that would have ultimately for business and for us as a society, I don't think were clearly explained. I absolutely understand that there will be consternation from businesses, particularly when we've had a long period of stability with taxation, when there is a change to the headline rate. And I think what the other problem is that it has also created some uncertainty about the future direction of travel. Now, we've already explained that there is the likelihood that a healthcare levy would be coming forward, similar to the one that they have in Jersey and the Channel Islands. So we're not alone in trying to figure out how we are going to pay for our ever-expanding healthcare service and the demands that are coming forward on healthcare for a number of very valid reasons, particularly around the demographic challenges that we're facing, but also because, you know, as yet there is a lot of unexplained increase in challenges, shall we say, across society. I don't think I'm not going to single out single group, but I've already talked about, for example, ADHD in children. So I think to sort of partly answer the second part, you know, I think the critical question is we've got to start opening up a bit and communicating more efficiently and effectively with our stakeholders, our island, our community, in whichever sector or position that they are in. I think the questions that we really clearly need to ask ourselves is, you know, if we're going to carry on funding healthcare to the sort of levels that were set out in Sir Jonathan Michael report, how we do that. And then we have to look at, of course, at the economic capacity, if you like, to be able to do that. I've always been a big believer in the best thing for society is the lowest possible tax rate. Because I think freedom of choice and freedom of opportunity is and encouraging hard work and personal success is the way forward versus this sort of large state cost looking after everybody and every single problem that everybody has. But equally, you know, it is that I can't escape the fact and we shouldn't escape the fact that these pressures appear to be growing, and that we've already had a report that was, what, 5-6 years old now, that highlighted to us that our level of expenditure into health did not appear to meet the levels that were necessary for us to offer level of care that society was asking for. So there are some serious conversations that we need to ask, and we need to be clear, though, I think, with ourselves as government, but also as a society, and what we can actually sustain when it comes to asking people to pay more for government services. And on the other flip side of the coin, of course, you know, not just health, but there are other areas within government that are being financed that could be put into, taken off the government payroll, if you like, and put into either different structures, or we ask them to be, rather than taking subventions, that they should be self-financing. So in other words, you know, this piece of work that I think there's been a bit of criticism about, saying, well, what aspects of government operations have you gone to and said, actually, you're no longer going to get taxpayer funding, or we think that you should find other ways to raise the revenue you need to run that piece of the operation, because we're going to take that money away and we're either going to bank it and save it, or we're going to need to invest it into the additional needs that we've got in health. So some of these are quite big questions, but you know, the core essence of it does need answering, and we need to reach some conclusions in the next 12 months, because there is absolutely nothing worse than uncertainty when it comes to this. And of course, you know, you have to ask the board of Manx Care and those in charge of delivering healthcare, you know, want to stick to their budget, absolutely, because we can't afford the extra expenditure. And secondly, they too will need to define themselves where the priorities lie within the whole health and social care remit, what does need extra investment, and try and find alternative solutions, perhaps where they can, to areas that are either struggling or have sort of come onto the radar, and perhaps are attracting less priority than the core service.
There are a number of your colleagues now who seem to be suggesting that maybe it's time for someone else to deliver. Do you still believe that you are the right person to deliver this, and do you still believe in your project?
Well, so first of all, I mean, it's not my project. Clearly, I am the chief minister or the first minister, and I head the council of ministers. As you say, each minister has a tremendous amount of power in their own responsibility and in their own right, and it is a collective. You know, we operate by collective responsibility, and often that can be quite testing, and it's not always absolute unity, but everybody is unified behind the island plan, because the essence of it, Phil, and most people I speak to agree, the essence of it, what we're trying to do, is right. So I'm absolutely confident that it is the right plan. I think what we need to do at the moment is just refocus, perhaps listen to some of the voices that have spoken up in the last few months, and just try and finesse, I think, particularly around this growth aspect, you know, trying to make it good growth. I think we have been probably just too focused on targets rather than perhaps finessing and understanding where that growth ought to be, and what parts of the economy will provide us greater security into the future. And I think we need to be clearer with the with everybody, really, what and where in public service delivery we really are focusing on, in terms of where that greatest need for the public is. And you know, I think clearly, you know, dentists, GP appointments, education, always, but you know, in helping those children, particularly sort of post-COVID, anybody impacted there, getting to the bottom of this rise in ADHD and things. So these are the types of priorities that we need to bring to the fore more, if that's the right expression, because as you say, sometimes people look at the island plan and say, oh, it's a nice plan, and I hear all these big things, but sometimes I don't really understand how that's translating in terms of helping me. But of course, I would also say to everybody, you know, at the heart of any successful nation surely is positive, strong economic growth. We've had to focus very much on that. for two and a half years because of all the challenges that, that we've been facing. I was at the careers graduate careers fair yesterday. It was tremendous to go out and talk to a huge significant number of businesses who were represented, to hear the positivity that was being reflected, the opportunities they had for staff and for staffing, and the variety, in fact, Phil, of the businesses. But I think we now need to perhaps, as I said, refocus, refresh, renew, be clear about what we've now translate some of that, I think, now into what this is actually meaning for our nation, for our citizens, and particularly, I mean, tackling some of these, perhaps tackling in a clearer way some of the day-to-day problems that everybody is facing, alongside, of course, having jobs and job securities and good income.
Moving on then, residency, migration and security. I suppose the first question on this is, no one was asked at the general election whether they wanted to see an extra 15,000 people come into live and work on the Isle of Man. How do you justify to the Manx people, many of whom will think, actually, this is not something I particularly want?
So, you know, before that, before the election, I think the analysis work that we had done around demographics was pretty clear. Okay, maybe there had not been enough, awareness, perhaps that analysis work, but I think certainly amongst business and key parts of the community that analysis had been done. I think there was an awareness of, for example, at the heart of this, of course, was this demographic population issue, not just here on the island, I mean globally as well. You know, we hear and recognise that. And of course, you know, we don't run political parties here. We bring together politicians from all sides of the spectrum and have been justifiably put there as their constituency representatives, as their representatives of the people in those particular areas, and are required to come together to bring some cohesion to the government and how the government is working and what its priorities for. So perhaps I might sort of throw that question back a bit and say, you know, when was the last time a government put together its island plan, or whatever they call it, its island its priorities or its program for government, and decided that they were going to go out and have some sort of referendum? I guess the tell from this will be the next general election and whether and how people are going to react to it. I mean, we will be 5 years through a program. We will not be anywhere near those sorts of figures, but absolutely will be a time where I guess people will tell those standing whether or not they want to continue pursuing that type of route, or if not, you know, where they would like the focus to be. And of course, but then you have to gear around that the capabilities of an economy to deliver. And it is quite complex because, you know, as an aging population, we are costing more, and I'm starting to put myself into that category as now. Well, you know, we're costing more and delivering less, and we're putting more requirements on the younger generation to cope and manage and deal with that. And clearly that all requires funding. So a lot of these questions are interlinked. I'm not saying that we've got all the answers, but what we have done is we've taken a clear direction to push forward. The elected representatives who voted and supported this can see the benefits of this plan. And, you know, I hope that when we get to the end of this administration, we will leave behind good evidence of brownfield site redevelopment, good evidence of economic progress. Clearly, ongoing discussions, I would expect, about the shape of public services. But we will have evidenced what this can achieve. And of course, I think you're absolutely right. You know, the people of the island need to have some proper say on that. And I guess that will be picked up because this has the opportunity to be a longer term vision. And, you know, then whoever the next group of politicians are, in a, you know, two and a half years time, will clearly have to decide whether or not to scrap this or pick out some of the best bits and redefine it, or to carry on. So
one of the other areas of this, though, that you mentioned is we will consider measures to help ensure that the overall mix of new Isle of Man residents contributes positively to our economy and our society. I was quite intrigued by that because certainly every time there's been a significant new residence drive, there has been a need to try and ensure that those people fit in. That's not an easy thing to do, is it?
Oh, so let me be clear. I mean, the focus around this is economically active people on the island, and it's, you know, if the next census doesn't show that we've increased the economically active numbers of people on the island, then we will not have been delivering what we set out to do. And again, I mean, I must emphasize, I mean, I think we've talked a lot about these numbers. Really, this was about growing the numbers of people who are working and contributing to our tax base.
And it's that ratio, isn't it, between economically active and economically inactive?
That's right. And we needed to grow that. And this provided a way forward for us to do that. And, of course, all the benefits that we've talked about of doing this, including, you know, the ability perhaps of town centres to grow and develop, perhaps enabling refocused building in town centres on brownfield sites, etc. So, you know, the important thing, and the message is really that this was about bringing jobs and employment and people to fill those jobs and gaps in our workforce, rather than just an out and out, oh, this is the population growth figure. And I think this is one of the things that we are sort of listening to quite a lot, in terms of some of the criticism that's come along, that actually perhaps you just want to understand a bit more about this being good growth for the island, rather than just actually there's another 1,000 people. Actually, we want to be clear that they are contributing, they make a positive contribution, they're in the right jobs, and that we're in it to industries that are also, you know, set well for the future as well.
One of the areas that I'd like to talk about, and, you know, I have to declare that I have a sort of an interest in this, in that I live very close to where you are proposing to put 20 megawatts of onshore wind, is your energy security new strategic priority. You talk here about it is critical that we make progress this year if we are to meet our climate change targets. There are other things that you could do. It feels, certainly as someone who has been a minister in a department, in the Department of Infrastructure, which does big schemes, that this is not only an ambitious target, it's an unrealistic target to deliver in the incredibly short timescales that you're talking about for this. And it does appear that all effort is going in to meet the target, to the extent that reasonable challenge is being largely ignored. Why is it critical that this has to be delivered by government in this very, very tight timescale?
I think we know we may need to make progress. Well, I think it was the point of that statement. And it does need to be brought forward through the relevant statutory processes, I think, at reasonable pace.
And I think if the relevant statutory processes were being followed, or, you know, if we had guarantees that these would be followed, I think a lot of people who are concerned at the breakneck speed that this is being pursued may feel a little bit reassured. But there does seem to be lots of evidence suggesting that things like the planning process, there's going to be a new process introduced which is going to speed things up, which means the opportunity for the public to have their say is going to be significantly weakened and diminished.
Well, I can absolutely assure you there's no plans for new processes or new statutory documentation, certainly not at this stage, and that, you know, this will follow the designed route and will follow the letter of the law, and people's objections will be heard, you know, one way or the other. And the point that we are making, I think we need to draw this back out to the greater positioning, is, you know, first of all, it's been clear to us for a number of years that there is a demand for us to provide evidence of the fact that we are, A, following our commitments when it comes to climate change, but also doing our best to provide the community and business with green, renewable energy that they can clearly evidence, so that as responsible citizens, they can say that with confidence that X, Y, Z, 20%, 30%, 40%, 100% in some cases of their energy is coming from renewable sources, and that we are contributing responsibly to the international agenda. The second point I would suggest is that, you know, we're only a decade or so from quite critical crunch points when it comes to the supply of energy on the island, where that supply is coming from and what that supply is actually made up of. Now, you know, I think there was a view that, that we would have the renewable energy put down the interconnector, and that the UK would progress with its plans, and that we would be accessing carbon-free electricity. But, you know, increasingly the language that is coming out now from the United Kingdom around gas power stations needing to build now more because they're not probably going to meet their targets, that people are concerned about brownouts, or basically electricity blackouts, if you like, you know, is language that concerns us. And I think that puts more emphasis on our need to make sure that we are maximizing our own capacity and capability to deliver electricity from and on the island itself, and specifically obviously when that comes to renewable energy. So I think again, this was messaging about, look, to particularly to the Manx Utilities Authority, look, we're not messing around. You know, you asked to keep your foot on the gas, and we're to go through the process. Because the bottom line is, if for whatever reason this process fails, and I don't know, but, you know, it doesn't get through planning, or planning inspector says no, or whatever, then clearly the island has got a position where it's going to have to rethink its approach. And that will require additional thought. It will also put back a program by some years. So, you know, I think we need to be satisfied ourselves, because there's risks attached to this, absolutely fully accept that, but we need to be satisfied ourselves that we are pushing this at pace, because the whole program itself needs to be pushed at pace. You know, we have a 2030 target that we set out. We've clearly got the 2050 target in statute, and we do need to make progress for a number of reasons. So that is why that emphasis is down in our island plan at the moment.
And of course, for people who are maybe a little cynical about the whole climate agenda, the positive about this is, I mean, certainly last time I looked, something like £160 million a year our money leaves the island to go to buy fossil fuels. £160 million is an awful lot of money, and this was probably 10 years ago when I last looked, so it'll be a lot more now. And keeping that money on the island because it's not required for purchasing fossil fuels must be a good thing for the Manx economy.
Yeah, I mean, there are economic benefits to renewable energy, particularly, you know, on the wind side of things. I think I would focus this more around energy security necessarily than just an obsession with climate change. I think we can see the benefits from turbines in terms of the electricity they produce. Okay, it's not a constant. We know, though, we are in a relatively good location to maximise wind and turn it into energy. And that's why we will be focusing hard on that. But it's not just the onshore programme as well, Phil. We are doing the very best we can to ensure that the opportunity we have with Ørsted and the seabed lease that they have is also turned into something tangible. And part of that commitment is also about making sure we're doing what we can with Ørsted, with our legislation, with our discussions with the UK, to make sure that we can put everything into making sure that project has got legs and will work in the best interests of the island as well.
Well, sadly, we haven't got time to do the other two. Maybe we'll have to do a part two at some point. The other two redefined strategic priorities. Housing, we'd sort of touched on anyway, and travel connectivity, air and sea, which you're hoping to improve the reliability there. But Chief Minister, thank you very much for joining us on this afternoon's programme.
It's been a pleasure, Phil, and happy Easter to you and all your listeners.
That was Chief Minister Alf Cannon, MHK. Are you convinced by Mr. Cannon's rhetoric? Has his government demonstrated real change that improves your life? or do you feel that we need a change at the top? I'm Phil Gorn, Gorymaios yn geistiochrom. Thanks for listening.